is the Criminal Law Revision Full Commission Meeting, January 18, 1969, 9:30 a.m., Room 4445, State Agricultural Building. Today's subject, Responsibility, Preliminary Draft Number 4.
Two members appointed to this commission Friday, and while we got word to all of them, their plans were such that it was not possible for some of them to come. Dave Frost, Representative Frost, a lawyer from Hillsboro, isn't it, Dave?
Right.
Is one of the new members. And Wally Carson, a lawyer from Salem, also a representative, has a speaking engagement in Corvallis, but he'll be here this afternoon. And Carl Haas, we're not certain whether he's able to attend. Chandler has notified Don some time ago that he couldn't attend. But as far as the rest of them, I presume that they'll be here a little late. And rather than wait until they all arrive, I think perhaps it's best that we get underway, because our secretary here takes excellent notes, and her minutes, as you, if you care to look at any in the past, are complete and thorough, and besides we have a tape to which they can listen. And Dale Harlan was the chairman of this particular subcommittee. He is no longer in the legislature, and consequently, by reason of the terms of the statute, he no longer qualifies. And Judge Burns was next in line on that particular subcommittee, so I'll ask Judge Burns to take over, if he will.
Well, first I'd like to welcome here three very ably qualified gentlemen from the field of psychiatry from Portland, Dr. Gerhard Haugen, Dr. John Butler, and Dr. Roger Smith, all of whom that were kind enough to accept my invitation to attend this meeting. And I think, according to what our custom has been in the past, at least I believe we have, Mr. Chairman, operated somewhat freewheeling, in the sense that as the mood strikes while we ask for contributions and suggestions, and because of the nature of the subject we're going to be discussing today, I would hope we'd be especially able to have your comments and suggestions as we go along. And it seems to me that since Professor Platt is the one who is responsible, if I may use that term, Mr. Chairman, we ought to start out by having Professor Platt go ahead and go through these section by section.
Thank you, Judge. I might say about that word responsible, I've just been reading Dr. Menninger's latest book, The Crime of Punishment, and he talks about that very word and the difficulties that psychiatrists and lawyers have with even a word like responsibility, because it has so many different meanings. It has, of course, the meaning that we're dealing with here, the legal meaning, and then, of course, the general meaning in which I hope you used it just now. And one of the problems that we'll face, and I think that the psychiatrists who are with us this morning would agree with this, is problems of communication between two helping professions. I hesitate to make a lot of remarks at the outset, but because I think it's better to deal with these problems as we go along. I would reflect, I think, the subcommittee's views with respect to the first section in the draft, which sets out the so-called test for determining responsibility, which is based entirely on the Model Penal Code.
Do you gentlemen have copies of this?
It was a general consensus, although I don't want to speak for those members of the subcommittee. I think we can all agree here that we did not view the actual test applied as the most crucial aspect of this particular article. It's generally recognized, I think, by those who have looked at the cases in Oregon and the cases elsewhere with respect to the definition of what responsibility is, that although the McNaughton rule applies in most states and has applied in Oregon since the very outset, it is not an inflexible rule as sometimes the stereotype would have it. The cases in Oregon and the practice in the Oregon courts seems to indicate that McNaughton has been applied very flexibly to the advantage, I believe, of the jury in most cases in trying to arrive at the basic question of responsibility. That is to say, the psychiatrists, when testifying, have been allowed the pretty free-ranging scope. In some cases, I recall Judge Byrne sent to me an abstract from one of his cases in his trial court. Testimony was allowed without any problem with respect even to the volitional element of the particular defendant's mental condition.
That may have been because I was on the subcommittee.
Well, I've noticed also some excerpts of testimony that have gotten into some of the cases reviewed in our Supreme Court, and it's indicated there the trial courts generally will take most relevant kind of testimony from psychiatrists with respect to determining the mental life or the mental condition of the defendant. Now, I'm not speaking in favor of McNaughton at this point. I'm simply pointing out that McNaughton has gotten a black eye, I think, because it is looked at as a stereotype too often. That is a rule which is not flexible, which has not allowed psychiatrists to testify in a more full or more fully. I realize that many psychiatrists do object strenuously to the language in McNaughton. It is categorical on its face and would seem to be very narrow. The McNaughton rule, I think, has grown over the last century and, well, almost 126 years now, I guess, that it's been in operation. The subcommittee, however, felt that McNaughton has in fact outlived its usefulness. That is, in practice, we are not really using and applying the strict old concepts from McNaughton, and therefore it's time to turn to a more flexibly stated rule if in fact we are not really adding new law or new rules to the practice currently. The rule chosen was the one presented here, the American Law Institute version of the Model Penal Code formulation. Its advantages, I suppose, are at least two. Number one, of course, it does recognize the control test and allows not only the testimony of the expert witness with respect to the defendant's control mechanisms, but also allows instructions under this rule to be given by the trial court to the jury. As heretofore, the jury has heard all these aspects of the case, but has never been able to have to be instructed specifically with respect to what it should do about the control or lack of it in a particular defendant. Secondly, of course, the language is less categorical. It speaks of substantial capacity, of appreciation of criminality. These words are legal words, of course, not medical. Appreciation extends into the rule not only the intellectual awareness, but also the emotional levels of awareness. Good psychiatrists generally, I don't wish to speak for anyone here, you understand, but from my studies and conversations generally, psychiatrists feel that they cannot testify categorically on the strictly intellectual level with any kind of helpfulness. Now, there are some other advantages to this rule. I would say it is, I believe, the rule of the future. It is now gaining momentum in the United States. It's been adopted in at least a half a dozen states in one variation or another, largely the provision we see here. At least seven federal circuits, Judge Burns pointed out to me just yesterday, the Sixth Circuit has now adopted the Model Penal Code version. So it is gaining favor in a number of jurisdictions. In contrast, I suppose the most interesting rule, the most interesting test, is the Durham test, which originated in 1954, I believe, in the District of Columbia Circuit. That test has been denied, has been presented in at least 22 jurisdictions, and has been denied in all of them, except the Virgin Islands and Maine, I believe, are the only two, besides the District of Columbia, which have adopted that rule. That is, volumes could be said about this particular subject, but I'm certainly not going to go any farther, and I would entertain any questions or open any discussion at this point.
Before we have a discussion, it seems to me perhaps it would be well if we'd have a statement of whatever length they feel they ought to make from each of the three psychiatrists who are here, and why don't you start, Dr. Butler, and then we'll move from there.
questions.
Why don't you, perhaps it'd be better if we had the, you have to sit at the round table there, the chairs that are in
there. Judge Burns, we also have a fourth psychiatrist,
yeah.
Daniel Boyce.
Well, we'd like to hear from all four.
And he is also well qualified.
That was a self-serving
statement. Would you like to come up to the table there?
What's office?
Yes. Well.
You need any help?
Pencil around here.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's lots of.
You're going to go on that boat trip
tomorrow. I got so much stuff here.
That's started.
If I get over to your jurisdiction.
That's all right. You're in good shape.
It's all right. I'll change it if it gets uncomfortable. It's all right.
Guess there is some serious ground now.
You.
I feel like I need to do a lot more listening before my comments can be very relevant to the proceedings here, but I might say I'm very glad to see actions taken to redefine criminal responsibility, because I think those of us who have been in practicing in psychiatry have been quite concerned that the rules as currently applied in the courts could be modified to provide the possibility that psychiatrists could make a more substantial contribution to the understanding of the of criminal responsibilities. I think that a number of questions should come up in the course of the day as we get into discussions about what happens when an individual is acquitted, what happens when he goes to the state hospital, how pre-sentence investigations are most appropriately taken out, conducted, carried out. Oh, I'd prefer to not make any more of a statement right now, other than to say that I'm listening. And,
Who wants to go next? And why don't you follow, Doctor?
Well, I feel somewhat like Dr. Butler, that maybe it'd be better to kind of wait and see what else is going to be said. I've had my experience with the business of testifying has been with some 10 years in the military, which is with Naughton and Irresistible Impulse, while concurrently I was doing a private practice and working in the state of New Hampshire, which has no legal test of responsibility, but something similar to Durham. Some people equate it with Durham. My own feeling was that it seems that since the courts and the law really doesn't define what a mental disease or defect is, that the interpretation of this, at least as I have used it, has been left up to the psychiatrist. So that aside from the issue of right and wrong, which I think is, and this reprint that I distributed, question the ethicality of a psychiatrist, or whether it's ethical for a psychiatrist to make statements in regard to right or wrong, this report of the Group for Advancement of Psychiatry. But as far as testimony, I've never felt too constrained by McNaught. I think there's a lot in it that could certainly be clarified and could open up the opportunity for freer provision of information about what's going on with the person who committed a particular offense.
Doctor, let me ask you, did you testify in the courts in New Hampshire?
On one occasion, I saw it in criminal courts.
was your impression there that the latitude of the testimony was any different under the New Hampshire rule than it would be under the McNaught rule?
Well, of course, I was in the military, and it was pretty rigidly adhered to. Also, I was a senior psychiatrist at a prison, and we had a lot of court-martials going on there, so I was in a position of being on staff and at the same time a psychiatrist for the defense, which is a kind of unique position to be in. And it was held, you know, fairly rigid. I never would testify with respect to right and wrong. I felt this wasn't a statement that I could make, or judgment I could make. I think that the latitude was the same then, aside from that, because And we had a staff which dealt with this question. We discussed it at some length. We had the responsibility for appeals from the military courts because we had the prisoners there, and then we would re-examine them. And the staff got these questions about the right and wrong and the Nature Equality Act and so forth. And we were of the consensus that we had to kind of define what was a mental disease or defect. It seemed to me that in New Hampshire, with the jury really defined as representative of the community what they would accept as mental disease.
Do you think it makes any real difference what rule you have as far as the actual jury results?
Frankly, no.
So, Doctor, do you believe that we should have a statutory, a more complete and full definition of mental disease and defect in our statute? Number one. Two, do you think it's possible to do that?
I don't know of anybody who's ever been really able to define it except operationally. So it becomes really a matter of what the community says. So in a sense, I think that with New Hampshire, you have something that's different in that the jury representing the community really decides, and the judge says something to the effect that, well, if this is a product of mental disorder or related to it in some way, yeah, it's up to the jury to decide whether or not
really
it gets off.
It really eventually depends upon a consolidation of the views of those particular 12 people on this jury.
That's my impression.
With all of our backgrounds and everything that they bring.
They represent the community.
Appropriate to that, I think it's interesting to observe in the Chicago jury study, you're probably familiar with that, the controls, some juries had submitted to them the same case, of course, one under the McNaughton rule, one under the Durham rule, and one under no rule. Just simply, do you find the defendant sane or not, I think was about the way the question was asked. And this is essentially, I guess, what you're saying, the New Hampshire approach. The results of that particular controlled test were that there was no difference in the incident of not guilty by reason of insanity verdicts between McNaughton and Durham, but there was a noticeable difference. That is, there were more verdicts of not guilty by reason of insanity under the no or the non-rule. It's interesting. Now, I don't know what we can determine from that, except that the constriction of the other two rules made no difference among themselves, but precluded the jury from reacting as it might have otherwise reacted, whether it's a non-rule.
There were more convictions.
There were more not guilty by reason of insanity under the non-rule.
Under the non-rule, mm-hmm. Which is kind of...
Have you an idea how much of an increase that was?
It was noticeable enough to be called a major difference. In the actual number of cases, they were small anyhow because it was a small controlled experiment. And I don't know, of course, what impact or implications this has overall. But it was an interesting, noticeable difference that the study turned up on that particular situation.
Is it true that there has apparently been some increase in findings of not guilty by reason of insanity in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
It's been applied?
It hasn't been, the figures I've seen have not been a substantial increase, but definitely an increase in the number of not guilty by reason of insanity verdicts.
Under Durham. George, what was the first statement that you made with respect to the study, that there's been an increase in acquittals on insanity grounds where?
Where there's no rule at all.
Where there had been no rule at all under this controlled experiment. But with respect to McNaughton and Durham, in comparison to those two, there was no appreciable difference in the way the juries reacted to the particular cases they heard.
But in the district,
since Durham, there has been an increase. Not a horrendous increase by any means, but there has been an increase in the not guilty in acquittals by reason of insanity.
I was wondering about Kearns and whether there was any difference in the district courts. Was it third district with respect to
I haven't
to
seen
that?
any studies of that at all.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask the doctors this question? What, in our present system in operation in Oregon, what do you think is wrong as the situation now stands? Do you think that our present system definition is not achieving justice?
I would agree with the remarks made earlier that we have, functionally, gotten along quite well under McNaughton. What I'm expressing are personal feelings, but I do feel, and I hope my fellows will agree with me, that even without a vote of confidence, I can speak for the State Psychiatric Organization, the Oregon District Branch, and the American Psychiatric, in feeling that a change is indicated, that Durham, in my own opinion, I've never testified under it, but I have friends in the district who have, Durham is too loose, allowing the recidivist, the chronically antisocial person, the pure character disorder, to be irresponsible. And I've long thought that the model penal code would be an ideal compromise. It will allow more latitude than I think we have sometimes now under McNaughton. Even though I think most of the judges give us a lot of latitude, we still feel constricted by the rigid wording of the existing code.
Mr. Chairman, two questions. First, Dr. Boyce, a follow-up of what Dr. Smith has just touched on. You said in your initial remarks that you felt that there was a lot in McNaughton that could be clarified. Now, can you first expand that a little bit and tell us where and how it should be clarified?
I'm not sure that's what I said. What I recall saying was that as far as a mental disease or a defect is concerned, you know, as it's stated in McNaughton, that this is something that can't be clarified, and it's something that individual psychiatrist, I feel, has to testify according to what his conceptual framework is with respect to what is a disease or a mental disease or defect.
It's what you were, I wrote down what you said, and maybe I misunderstood it or you didn't exactly say what you intended, but is what you were saying simply that under the right-wrong test as we have it in McNaughton, it's kind of a black or white situation, and when you're dealing with these people who commit some of these crimes, it's not all black or white. In other words, they may know the difference between right and wrong, but nevertheless their action may be the result of a mental disease or defect, and the element of diminished responsibility attaches. Is this what
I'm saying? Is I don't think it's appropriate, at least in this gap report that you have points this out, and I've felt this for a long time, I don't think it's appropriate for a psychiatrist to testify. I don't think it's within his province to testify whether someone knows whether something is right or wrong. I do think that it's appropriate for the psychiatrist to testify as to what he felt was the motivation in the crime and the offense, and what kind of incapacity the individual has, and all of the circumstances that come to bear upon the commission of the crime. I've had this come up repeatedly. I had a case in the district court of a bank robber. No question the man knew right from wrong in whatever way one would want, the most rigid way that one would want to construe this, but it was completely, you know, it just didn't fit. It wasn't appropriate at all.
You're talking about a subjective test.
Talking about making a moral judgment by someone who's supposed to be a behavioral scientist and remove themselves to the extent of looking at what's going on with this particular individual under these circumstances, and that the judgment about whether it's right or wrong would be made by the court or by the jury.
Well, doctor, pardon me for interrupting, but during the course of an examination, and after you have had all the exposure to the person involved that you desire, in most cases, is it possible for the psychiatrist to form this conclusion as to whether or not that person did know right from wrong? You said that it wasn't appropriate. My question is whether it isn't appropriate for him to testify or not. Just as a matter of fact, I would like to know if it is possible in most cases for the psychiatrist to form that ultimate conclusion.
To talk about what the motivation of the offense was for the individual and what prompted it, whether it was part of a delusional system, such as this bank robber had the idea that he would rob these banks, and he did successfully a number of them, and then that this would break the loan companies, which in turn were charging usurious rates, which were, you know, and that then this would be a kind of Robin Hood sort of activity that he was involved with. He knew that society considered the robbing of banks wrong, but he considered it his mission to carry through this particular plan. So what I'm saying that you could ask the man and he could tell you, yes, he knew it was wrong, that society would consider it wrong. I don't. But he had his reasons, and the motivations were tied into a rather elaborate delusional system.
But you're saying, in effect, then, that the function of the psychiatrist is not to make that determination, but rather to produce in testimony all of the factors which are involved, and then allow the jury to form that conclusion.
That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Then you would favor a no test.
Along what you've exactly been saying, that the difficulties with understanding the language of McNaughton, here's a beautiful example, the word wrong. What does it mean? In McNaughton, nobody really knows from the very outset of the case. Does it mean moral wrong? Or does it mean criminally defined statutory wrong, let's say? Well, the Model Penal Code solves that ambiguity by using the word criminality. And, of course, that equates the wrongfulness of the defendant in his own mind with crime as defined in society, not the fact that God told him to kill, which would not be morally wrong in his mind, but certainly would be criminal, or would constitute criminality under the Model Penal Code version of that particular aspect.
Would constitute something against which society needed to protect itself.
Yes, and has defined as a crime.
Judge Burns.
I was going to see if Dr. Hogan would have a comment at this point.
Yeah. First, regarding what you're talking about, of course, a psychiatrist is not supposed to understand, testify as to whether or not the individual knew the difference between right and wrong. There are very few persons who, at the time they're committing a crime, are debating with themselves, is this right or is this wrong? This is a medical examination, and it's to determine whether or not some condition might exist which made him incapable of making this determination. Well, that's a side issue. the reason I feel justified in taking some of your time here is because I have had a rather unique experience. For the past 19 years, I've been a psychiatric consultant for the State Parole Board. And, of course, in past years, I've also been involved in a number of criminal trials, both prosecution and defense. And so it's only natural that in viewing these people that I view for the parole board, I also have some curiosity and speculations in my own mind. What would have happened? Did they have an insanity plea legitimately under the McNaughton rule? Would they have it under some other rule, and so forth? And I would venture that, well, first let me tell you who I see. I see for the parole board persons who have committed murder, armed robbery, or any other crime of violence, any sex crime or arson. I seldom see the check cashier or the simple burglar or so forth unless there's some special problem. But of those that I see, I think that in fully half of these cases, if I were called by the defense as a psychiatric witness to testify at this individual's trial under this proposed rule, I would have to say that, in my opinion, there existed a defect in substantial capacity to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. Now, that is including, of course, persons whose act was influenced to some extent by alcohol. In other words, this rule would exclude those who had planned an act and had taken reasonable precautions not to get caught and so forth. But in our penitentiary, we have a minor number of these. We don't have an organized crime and a great amount of criminality as a profession and so forth, like you might have in Illinois or Pennsylvania or New York or some situation. We have here mostly individuals who have character personality defects, and I characterize it mainly in that they have more than ordinary inability to say no to themselves when they are emotionally aroused or strongly tempted. They're not sociopaths. The sociopaths are in the definite minority in this penitentiary. Let me give you a typical sort of example. Here's a sawmill worker, marries a woman, she has a 14-year-old daughter, quite buxom, well-developed, already been around with the boys quite a bit. And so some night, while the wife is over taking care of a sick sister, and the daughter climbs in bed with the stepfather. Well, in my opinion, at that time, there would exist substantially defect in judgment and so forth, so that under the rule he would lack substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. And so this is a...
But would that have been a result of mental disease or defect?
It's a result of a defect in that this man, and it, you don't have to be much of a psychiatrist to go back into the histories of these people and find evidences of this type of defective behavior in the past. In other words, it's characteristic. We have great many persons in society who qualify under this definition. Most of them are lucky and it never brings them in trouble with the law. It's a very common defect.
Can I ask a question at this point,
yeah.
Doctor? But wouldn't your hypothetical there be covered by subsection 2, mental disease or defect does not include an abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or antisocial conduct? Wouldn't that rule out in that case?
Not as a rule. As is indicated in the notes here further on, there are a great many persons who are basically sociopaths who don't have any criminal record, particularly if they come from a rather good family. And so this would not rule it out. No, in this type of case that I have just cited to you, this might be the first time, but what I'm trying to point out is you could find defects in his handling of his daily life, which would show this tendency, that this inability, as I say, to say no to himself under a situation of this kind. It's personality, it's not sociopath.
That those acts in the past or tendencies wouldn't have to relate to the same type of action with which he was involved at the moment.
No, this would probably be the only time that would be this particular type of action. But it would have to do with perhaps going in debt, buying a lot of things that he didn't need. It would have to do with his interpersonal relations. It would have to do with his quitting jobs for poor reasons. Many, many different things.
Getting drunk on his way home when he fully intended to get there at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, all of those things. Well, anyway, another interesting thing that I ran across, and this was pointed out to me first by Dr. John Evans, who was the first psychiatric consultant to the state parole board, that there's a surprising number of individuals in the penitentiary who commit a crime during a depressed state. And I would say it probably run up around 10% of those that I examine. Most often, this is a depressive reaction brought about by a fellow being turned down by his girl, or a fellow's wife leaving him, or some such thing. And quite often, of course, it results in him going out and overusing alcohol. But even without this, a good many of these people then will commit a criminal act more or less on a revenge basis. And this is rather a childish type of reasoning. You'll be sorry you did this to me now when you see what happens. And actually, a fair number of them commit their crimes in such a way that you can see they're taking no precautions against being caught. They're practically inviting being caught. Well, this would be a portion of this roughly 50% that I would say had a defect which substantially decreased their capacity to conform to the law.
Doctor, what effect, suppose we made this change and went to the ALI rule here in Oregon, what effect do you think it would have in terms of actual results in actual cases? How many more or less?
Well, again,
verdicts or findings of not guilty by reason of insanity would there be under this one as opposed to the present rule?
I don't know. After all, you know, an awful lot depends upon how good a lawyer you have. A lot depends on the community. I've seen cases that were defended in the home community that were lost, where I think that the person would have been found guilty, not guilty by reason of insanity if there had been a change in venue. Very often in a small community, everybody's up in arms about it and so forth, and the individual doesn't have a chance. And
depends on how good the psychiatrist is, too.
And it depends upon whether the guy that got shot had a shooting coming.
Yeah. This is true.
That's a personal comment.
But again, you see, really, when it come right down to it, I think one of the main things that bothers us as psychiatrists is this confounded hypothetical question, whereby any sharp lawyer can make the two psychiatrists, one on each side, seem to be at sorts of points with each other when actually they don't disagree very much. But you can load hypothetical questions in such a way that they get very dramatic. And I think that plays a bigger part than how good the psychiatrist is. Because after all, a psychiatrist is rather limited to his testimony. In his testimony, he can be cut off from testifying quite easily. And so I don't know what the difference would be in actual results. All I know is that with a clear conscience, I could go in for the defense and indicate that, in my opinion, this man did at that time, by reason of mental defect, lack substantial capacity to conform with the law in a great many cases.
Ms. Burns, may I ask you a question? What difference would it make from an evidentiary point of view whether we had the McNaughton, the model penal code formulation, or the Durham or no test at all?
I think the main difference that it would make would be, I believe the rule to be generally in most courts that you cannot in Oregon presently ask a question ask an opinion question which is framed in either ALI or Durham terms. I don't think you can ask the ultimate question. When you ask the ultimate question, it has to be framed in McNaughton terms. My impression is that short of that, it doesn't make a bit of difference as to what scope the psychiatrist actually has in his testimony, and what difference it would make in the ultimate result of jury verdicts. I must say I'm still persuaded that it would make practically none, but here I'm basing this on the result of a very few cases that I have seen personally, and upon the Chicago jury experiment that Professor Platt talked about. I think Bruce Spaulding would probably be much more equipped to respond to that than I would.
I tend to agree. I've always thought that insanity defense usually is a peg to hang your hat on when you haven't got any other defense.
Right.
And if the reason you haven't got any other defense is that the law says you can't commit this act, but it permits the jury to weigh the situation and determine whether or not in their minds this fellow is really criminally wrong. In other words, what I said a while ago, if the guy had a shooting coming, the jury is very likely to find not guilty by reason of insanity if they believe that. And I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference what your rule is.
Judge
Berman, as long as you can get to the jury with the defense.
My last question. I'm curious as to why it's proposed that this be a matter of legislation instead of leaving it in the hands of the Supreme Court as it has been heretofore. It would seem to me the best position to decide. They've shown flexibility. They have tended to modify a little bit. And I was wondering, why don't you trust the Supreme Court?
Well, it's presently a matter of statute in Oregon.
And when the defendant is found not guilty, the Supreme Court never gets it.
No, but I mean,
the right and wrong rule is a matter of statute under Oregon law.
What number?
Is it?
What number?
Is it?
It's 136.
It's part of the insanity defense
procedurally
chapter.
Procedurally, it is.
All right. I was mistaken. I'd been informed.
It doesn't refer directly to the McNaughton formula.
No, it doesn't.
It's directed at the morbid propensity, which means specifically that section would prohibit a model penal code version because the model penal code contains a control element, and the statute specifically prohibits that. And the Supreme Court has been asked on a number of occasions by attorneys coming to the court with their case to establish a control test or to expand the McNaughton rule. And the court has said, you are in the wrong place, you must go to the legislature. We cannot do it, even though we think that a better rule might be formulated.
Well, that answers my question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Haugen, your sawmill worker, he would fall within the scope of Section 1 and would be entitled to be acquitted, would he not?
Well, I don't know. All I can say is that I would, with a free conscience, testify that, in my opinion, he lacked the substantial ability to conform his conduct with the law at that time.
His conduct was a result of a mental disease, right? Or
defect.
A mental defect. Okay. So, in psychiatric terms, what's the practical difference between this and the mental product test that's set out in Durham? That's the question that I wrestled with when I've gone over this.
Not a great deal.
There really isn't, is there? Now, here's a problem that I ran into time and time again as a prosecutor. And I moderated a little bit since I used to prosecute. We had the habitual exposures, the people who you would charge with indecent exposure, that's the misdemeanor, which under our present law can possibly carry an habitual penalty up to life. But I prosecuted dozens of these people who had been convicted as many as 8 or 10 times previously, some of whom were under the care of a psychiatrist at the time they were picked up on a school grounds exposing themselves. most of whom had been civilly committed. There's no question, and you reach the point where you lock them up in the county jail for a year because you just didn't know what else to do with them. No question whatsoever that what they were doing was the result of a mental defect, and they were viewed with a mental disease at this time. They knew the difference between right and wrong. What do you do with these people?
Of course, as Jake Tanzer said on a number of our subcommittee meetings, ultimately what I think we're after is a rule which will, as far as possible, produce the result that those people who need, who can respond best to correctional treatment, get into the correctional system, and those who can respond best to mental treatment, get into the mental health system. And because really, that's what you're saying when you acquit a guy by reason of insanity. Most of the time, you're saying, in effect, that this guy committed a pretty grave antisocial act in most cases, and we think it's better for him to go to state hospital and to the penitentiary.
That's really
what they're saying.
Well, that isn't true in the cases that Bruce was describing.
Oh, well, but those...
They don't want that fellow to go to the hospital or anything else. They just think under these circumstances there was actual provocation and the guy had it coming. I don't think that even enters into their thinking, the juries.
But I would say in the very sizable number of the, say, the serious assault cases with a knife or a weapon of some kind of murder, by and large, your murder cases, there's something seriously wrong with this individual. And so what are you going to do with him? Where are you going to end up with that fellow? You're going to end up in the state pen or the state hospital. This is really, it seems to me, what the jury ultimately decides. And
but isn't that true of nearly all criminal conduct? There's something wrong with the guy.
Well, sure, there's something wrong with the guy in the sense that, he's a defendant in a criminal case, whereas...
Yes, but he got there because of some...
Some defect.
Some defect, right. To some extent.
I mean, 90% of the time, anyway.
Yeah.
Now, I think someday we'll arrive at the point, it would be, at least it's interesting to think about, and it's been suggested by a lot of psychiatrists and lawyers and judges, exactly what you're saying, that our system is completely misdirected as far as defining crimes and separating people on the grounds of their own personal culpability, when in fact, the argument goes, they have none in the sense that the law has traditionally viewed it. They are the products of their environment and the products of their chromosomes, and they are what they are. And they have no free choice, and it comes down to that argument. Professor Packer has written another very interesting book just out on the limits of the criminal sanction, and he says it will be a wonderful day when the psychiatrists have advanced their science to the point where a Rorschach type test or something similar to that can be given to us all at an early age so that we can predict the kind of problems we're going to have with each one of us. In which case, of course, the present system of criminal law as we know it would have to be vastly different.
Doctor?
But we haven't reached that point, unfortunately.
Doctor?
I'd like to make two comments. One in regard to your comments about the voyeur. Voyeurism is almost, practically untreatable. And I've had the experience of seeing people repeatedly who come in. Usually they come in after they've been picked up, but even someone who will come in because he's in enough anxiety or threat about the difficulty he may get into will not stay in treatment. The treatment of a neurosis with this particular kind of symptomatic expression is years with the most skilled kind of therapist, and it just isn't available, maybe for a few people, but as a rule they don't stay. So you're confronted with somebody you can't change by locking them up, that can't really control this. I suppose this would even fit in under irresistible impulse. you know, and yet, and it expresses a mode of adapting that society has sanctions against.
I think we're going to have to accept the concept of quarantine here. This is old and it's legitimate, and that persons like Dr. Boyce is talking about here, we're simply going to have to quarantine them for the protection of society.
This is what we did in 1965 with the Civil Commitment Act for the sexually dangerous, in essence, isn't it?
But is a man who exhibits himself sexually dangerous? It may be upsetting to a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a great misunderstanding about that particular conduct, isn't there? It's not generally dangerous, is it, Doctor?
It's not generally dangerous, no.
For a woman, it's perfectly all right.
Certainly offensive.
But yeah. For a man, it's into trouble.
As long as it's to people under 12, as far as the women are concerned, it's all right.
I was at a meeting the other night of where I heard, on the one hand, the man who's the head of the vice squad in Portland make the specific statement, and he was seated next to Dr. Gable at the time, he made the specific statement that peepers were the worst of all, and that they were the most likely to be and become dangerous. And Dr. Gaber quickly said that he thought that was utter nonsense, although he was polite enough not to use those words. And here we have two people, both of whom are reasonably expert in the field, and reasonably see a lot of these people, and yet exactly an opposite conclusion. I've had many talks with Sergeant McDaniel of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, who's a pretty sound sergeant fella, and he deals with the sex cases. And he is not persuaded that lawyers are as harmless as is generally suggested by psychiatrists. I'm not persuaded. I've had a number of cases recently where we have worked along with those accused of indecent exposure and required as a condition of probation that they treat at the county mental health clinic and so on, and then have graduated to aggressive sexual acts against others.
There is a secondary problem here that's of considerable concern to the district attorneys that I would like to raise at this time, Mr. Chairman, about this area of the mentally ill. And that is, at the present time, there are perhaps 25 to 30 inmates in the penitentiary who are mentally diseased. They really belong in the state hospital. There is no facilities there for receiving them. The same situation obtains at Fairview. There are seriously disturbed and dangerous mentally retarded in Fairview, under very limited security, who are real problems. Now, what is happening in order to meet this situation at the state hospital of a lack of facilities, they are obliged to release many times serious and dangerous, disturbed, criminally insane who are getting out into the community, back into the community upon release from the state hospital and committing serious offenses, even homicides. So the district attorneys are thinking along these lines that there should be some method for perhaps a judicial hearing on the release of these people from the state hospital. And this goes in line with what Dr. Haugen is saying about the quarantine. I think that we should give consideration to a provision here for a judicial determination on the prior to the release of these people back into the community.
I agree.
General, you're certainly correct. This is one of the real crucial problems, the procedural discharge of these people. And Oregon has had very inadequate law on it, and we have tried to cover this in some detail in Section 10 of this draft.
Maryland President.
To make a judicial hearing rather than a discharge by the hospital, as now is the practice.
That particular proposal will not meet with the approval of the staff at the hospital, though, because I discussed it with them in the last session and had a bill that I was going to introduce. But
they do not want a judicial determination prior to release.
That it's a medical decision or an administrative decision should be made by the staff. I'd be interested, Mr. Chairman, in hearing the reaction from the doctors present with respect.
Dr. Smith?
Well, I wasn't reacting to that, but since I have the floor momentarily, the question was raised as if there were a change in the statute, whether there would be more defenses and whether this would be a better situation from the standpoint of the court, which I can't answer. But I think from the standpoint of the psychiatrist, a change such as is embodied in Section 1 here would certainly provide me with more latitude in speaking about how the personality, the disease, the motivation of the patient contributed to whatever crime he committed. Now, I don't think it would give me as much latitude as it would give Dr. Haugen. I'll disagree with him. Psychiatrists are like attorneys. They're forever in disagreement. I would have to, in my own case, be able, in this patient, to make a diagnosis, one that's conformed with the International Classification of Disease Number 8 from the World Health Organization, which is what we function under.
I'll disagree with him.
In due time, Doctor. And this, I think, would exclude for me the personality disorders for the most part, not all of them, because there are some personality disorders which are reflective of an underlying psychosis or an underlying mental deficiency. But I do think a change would give me a greater opportunity to communicate what I think about the patient to the jury.
Would it have, do you think on the basis of your experience, would it have, let's say, would it result in a 50% increase in not guilty by reason of insanity verdicts, or 30%, or can
well,
you?
Well, just as a guess, I would say it probably wouldn't make much difference in the number of pleas made, because I think even now, and perhaps more with a broader law, the defendant himself would elect not to take this defense, because if he just takes his chances, he might get 1 to 5, but if he qualifies as insane, he may be locked up the rest of his life. And I think there are a lot of people who would qualify even now who sometimes, either they or their attorney, elect not to take this.
That has been a suggestion which has been voiced here in the past. My own inquiry among most of the fellows that do a great amount of the defense work in Portland now indicates almost without exception that that the possibility of a long-term commitment to the state hospital hardly ever even enters into the decision of whether or not to assert insanity as a defense. This is at least according to the ones I've asked, and I've asked a number who do a lot of the criminal defense work in Portland and have in the last several years. And I don't know. Do you think, Doctor, the ALI rule would get more people into the state hospital who ought to be there and who are now presumably going to the correctional institution?
I think I'd say yes to that. Certainly more of them.
Dr. Boyce, you indicated disagreement with part of what he was saying.
Well, my disagreement had to do with the question of the use of diagnosis and diagnostic nomenclature, which I think is meaningless. To say that somebody is schizophrenic really doesn't say anything. And it comes back to something else I wanted to comment on. And I think that if the psychiatrist in his testimony can give some idea of the strengths of the individual and his ability to adapt and look at the crime, whatever it may be, in an adaptational framework, what it means in terms of the individual and the community and the environment and his way of dealing with what's going on inside of him, as well as with what he's confronted with outside. I wonder if we couldn't, if we began to think that way, whether we couldn't get away from this somewhat, this old bugaboo about mental defect and disease and so forth, because this is really, I think, what we're really talking about. That what is, that how is society going to protect itself, for one thing, and then the other thing is, how are we going to separate between someone who is, quotes, mentally ill and someone who is a criminal? And it seems we get into an insoluble dilemma when we start trying to separate this out. And this is what Menninger talks about so clearly in his book, and others have spoken about. And so when we talk about diagnosis, this is where I was disagreeing. I think that it's meaningless in trying to give us any idea of the likelihood of an offense being repeated, or of the adaptive capacities of the individual, or his culpability.
Dr. Butler, do you think that more people would be acquitted by reason of insanity if we adopt the ALI rule in Oregon?
I think more often psychiatrists would, as Dr. Hagen suggests, more psychiatrists would be able to say that the individual was not responsible, was not criminally responsible. Whether that would result in turning more of the juries into making the final agreement that the individual was not guilty by reason of insanity, I don't know. While I have the floor, let me say that I think one of the things that has led me to decide to try to give testify as insanity as a defense is, if I have a feeling the individual is treatable, if by response to psychotherapy, by response to hospitalization, his behavior can be modified by treatment, that I'm much more likely at that time to try to implement a defense of insanity. If I evaluate the individual in terms that make me feel he is not going to respond to psychiatric treatment, I'd be much less inclined, and that's something that I suspect all psychiatrists have as somewhat of a determinant of their decisions.
What you're really doing is saying, where should this guy go?
Yeah, I think that's the basic question. Where should he go? And more than on the basis of mental defect or mental disease.
Well, actually,
is he treatable?
If he is, if he will not be susceptible to treatment, you haven't any further interest in him, and insanity will not prevail, there's an individual who may be going to the penitentiary who quite clearly shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
I would disagree in this matter of treatability, because in common with general medicine, we have quite a few people who are not treatable, but whose diagnosis clearly, even under McNaughton, would exclude them from responsibility. They would be irresponsible, organically damaged individuals, for instance.
Yeah.
You'd have more under McNaughton.
Mental defect and some of the chronic, long-standing psychoses. Forgive me for using labels, but I have to do this. And I think these labels are valuable, because I'm a sort of an orderly, compulsive kind of a pig, and I think most attorneys are too, that they have pigeonholes that they
Pigs?
Need to put things in.
I'd like to comment on Mr. Thornton's remarks about persons mentally ill being in the penitentiary. I think I've seen all of them. And in my opinion, at least, those that are there are not treatable. I see no advantage to them being over in the state hospital. And personally, if I were going to be incarcerated for a number of years, I would much rather be in a penitentiary than in a state hospital. It would be a much more pleasant, interesting place to spend my time. I'd have better company and more to do and everything else. And so at present, with our limited abilities to do something about so many of these things, I don't think that's too important where they are quarantined.
Do they get treated in the state hospital now when they are sent there after being found guilty by reason of insanity?
Well, it seems to me that a good many people who are sent there as being found guilty by reason of insanity, the plea was temporary insanity. In other words, that at the time of commission of the crime, they were unable to know what they do, but now are okay. There it is. They're found capable of standing trial and all that sort of a thing. And of course, very often sending such people to the state hospital is maybe a little bit silly, because they are no longer that way. Well, I saw a case down in Astoria recently. Man committed a murder. Probably he had a drop in blood sugar due to his intake of alcohol, as the factor in the thing. Never had been in any trouble before, and I'm sure he'll never be in any trouble again. He was found not guilty by reason of temporary insanity, but he was sent to the state hospital. Well, I think that's just kind of silly. He's just taking some room there.
Well,
yes, I believe that Dr. Trelevin testified before the subcommittee that as far as persons involved in crimes are concerned, the ones they have at the state hospital are those who are who have been adjudged unable to stand trial because they couldn't understand the nature of the charge or unable to assist in their defense.
Yeah.
Wasn't that
much his testimony? He indicated that most of the ones that are sent there after a not guilty verdict are out inside of 6 months or so.
That's right.
But most of the inmates are awaiting trial as soon as they're found to be fit to stand trial.
That's
12, 14, 18 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Ways and Means Committee was over at the State Hospital Monday, I think, or Tuesday, and they're remodeling Section 38, or it used to be 38, I guess, and they're putting an additional 30 beds in their maximum security because of the tremendous press that they've had on the state hospital from the Penn and the Correctional Institution under this interinstitutional transfer program. But to get to the heart of the problem that you raised, Doctor, what you're saying is it doesn't do them any good. Maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought I understood you to say it doesn't do them any good to go to the state hospital. And if you follow that through, then by adopting Section 1 here, which might make it easier for acquittals because of insanity and consequently send more people to the state hospital, maybe we're not solving the problem. Maybe we're compounding it.
No, we're not solving the problem because we do not as yet have sufficient skills and knowledge to do a great deal with any large number of persons who get into trouble with the law, whether at the penitentiary or state hospital either. We just don't know how.
Well, let me explain very briefly a case I had that disturbed me terribly. If you've examined most of the people at the Penn, you know this guy because he's teaching school up there. And he was a school teacher in Portland and had a master's degree and a wife and a bunch of kids. Was active in his church and in his Boy Scout program. He's about 30 years old. He'd never been in trouble before. And one day, he took his wife down to the train station to meet her parents. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, he stopped in front of a real estate office in southeast Portland, and he went in and he raped a 59-year-old woman. Now, I prosecuted that case. It was an insanity defense, and I don't think any of you gentlemen were the defense.
I examined him.
You examined him. All right. We convicted him because of the manner in which he parked his car. It was obvious that he parked it in such a manner as to provide for a quick getaway. He brought a bottle of Vaseline in there with him, which was obvious to me and the judge that this was an element of premeditation. After he raped the woman, he tied her clothes up in knots so that she couldn't follow him out. He took a gun with him and held it at her head. Now, I was terribly disturbed in prosecuting that case because I knew that that man suffered from a terrible mental disease. There had to be something wrong. He was convicted, and he got 10 years. And he's up there teaching a bunch of fourth grade classes on the third floor of the Penn. Now, the deputy warden said to me, all we can do is keep him until he gets a few gray hairs in his head so that maybe when he gets out he won't do such a foolish thing again. That's not right. However, had we had the ALI rule, he in all likelihood would have been acquitted. I believe that if had he been acquitted and gone to the state hospital, maybe he could have been treated and rehabilitated to the point where he could go back on the street. Now,
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I examined him at the courthouse, and I've seen him in that pen, and in my opinion, this is a chronic schizophrenic, basically.
What's going to happen when he goes back on the street, when he finishes up his dead time?
Unpredictable.
This is a terrible problem.
You feel he's untreatable? You feel he's untreatable?
Yeah, I think it's a chronic thing. Chronic undifferentiated.
So I gather you feel he's just as well off in the penitentiary as he would be in the mental hospital.
Definitely.
Yes.
He wouldn't be teaching school and enjoying himself in this way over at the penitentiary, Ward 38. He's much more comfortable in the pen than he would be over there.
Would he be one of the people who would be discharged within 6 months from the state hospital if he were to have been found not guilty?
Well, you'll have to ask the state hospital people about that.
I wonder.
What is the difference in treatment that they receive, state hospital and the penitentiary? Those that are clearly not there awaiting trial or anything. But take a person who has been found guilty by reason of insanity.
Not guilty, you mean?
I mean not guilty.
Yeah. Well, if he's been found not guilty by reason of insanity, he doesn't go to the penitentiary.
He goes to the bughouse.
Yeah. That's what I mean. What is the difference in the treatment that is given to one who is in the penitentiary and one who is in a mental institution?
Well, if he is in the penitentiary, there is a psychiatric consultant from the state hospital, sometimes two, that come over there for a few hours a week. They see cases that are primarily that are referred to them by the administration, by the medical department over there. If, for example, a man seems to be developing an acute depression, is liable to hang himself or something like that, then he'll probably transfer him over to the state hospital. He'll probably have electroshock therapy and so forth, just like anybody else. And then when he is considered to be sufficiently improved, he'll be transferred again back to the penitentiary. Possibly it's a situation, mild schizophrenic, gets a little bit agitated and so forth, then maybe he will stay in a penitentiary, but they will prescribe some of the phenothiazine drugs and so on that are used in treating this. I have no criticism of the attention that they get. The men that come over there seem to be interested. I think they're capable, and I think if they feel that there's any possibility that they might benefit from being over at the state hospital, they have no hesitancy in transferring them over there.
I take it you disagree then with Attorney General Thornton with respect to being 20 or 30.
No, I don't.
That should be in the hospital, I mean.
Oh, that should be in a hospital. Yes, I disagree on that. I see no advantage to them. I believe that every one of these individuals that might benefit from treatment, and even some that couldn't, are transferred over to the state hospital. Dr. Succo, who's in charge pretty much of that thing, is very interested in doing everything we can with these people.
I wonder if, really, to talk about the subject of Section 1, it seems to me that we also ought to talk at the same time about Section 10, which provides for the what happens to them when they're found not guilty by reason of insanity. And I wonder, Professor Platt, if you would give us an outline of the detail of Section 10 so we can discuss that in context of Section 1.
Yes. Assuming then
what
that
page?
25.
Assuming the verdict has been entered by the jury, not guilty by reason of insanity, and the court has, under procedures found elsewhere in this draft and now exist under statutes, has found that not only is the person suffering from mental disease or defect, but is also dangerous and ought to be committed and does commit the individual. Now, he's in the Oregon State Hospital at this point, and the question is, how does he get out? When and if it's appropriate for him to get out. Currently, there is no statutory provision covering this, which is strange, and by practice, the state superintendent of the state hospital has made these decisions of when to discharge one committed under this procedure. Now, Section 10 will change this and would have this effect. When the judge finds that the person ought to be, when the jury finds him guilty, but not guilty of reason of insanity, the judge may release him under supervised custody or supervision back to society. Again, if the judge feels, on consulting with psychiatrists, that the man, even if he is still suffering from a disease or defect, is not dangerous. Therefore, he could presumably qualify for the McNaughton rule of being mentally diseased or defective and still be released by the judge upon showing to the judge that he would not be a danger in the physical sense to society. That's one way that he could be discharged. Or, if the judge feels that he is dangerous, he might commit him to the Oregon State Hospital. We put in this particular section a fixed term, not a term, but a fixed period of 5 years. The maximum then for holding a person in the hospital or for holding a person on supervised release in the community would be 5 years. At this point, if of course nothing has occurred in the interim to lead to his discharge, he will be under Section 10 entitled to an automatic hearing whether or not he should be retained in the custody of the Oregon State Hospital. Now, this is where we deal with the problem of the dangerous offender. The man who, let's assume that your rapist has been instead sentenced to the hospital rather than given a 10-year term in the penitentiary. If he gets 10 years or 5 years in the penitentiary and at the end of that term is still dangerous, there's nothing that society can do. He must be released. If at the outset, however, he's found not guilty by reason of insanity because of his mental disease or defect is committed to the Oregon State Hospital, at the end of the five-year period, no help has been able to give this man. He's not treatable. The superintendent of the hospital and the psychiatrists clearly indicate this to the court. The court may leave him in the state hospital. So it is possible in this kind of an extreme case for a man to remain his entire life in the state hospital. This would solve the kind of problem that you're talking about. But also, the section is here for another purpose, and that is to release those who ought not to be in the state hospital, who nevertheless may still qualify under our legal concept of mental disease or defect as being mentally diseased or defective. Now, we're talking here, I suppose, about the petty thief, the check casher, the one who's not a physical threat to society, that is, who's not a threat to his own person or the person of others, who's taking up space in the hospital and ought not to be there. Well, in this case, the superintendent can certify to the court again. The court makes the ultimate decision that he should be released, although he still is diseased or defective. Now, the big difference here that has been discussed is that the court is making this ultimate decision. The committee discussed this at some length. I think we should remember at the very outset of this procedure, the decision is not medical, it's legal. It's a decision of a court and jury. Now, this is historical. It may not be the proper way to do things, but this is the way our society functions.
It's with the assistance of medical.
Absolutely, with the definite assistance of a medical the practitioner, but it is ultimately the responsibility of society through its criminal system. Now, since the community is expressing itself through the judge and the jury in putting this particular person where he's been sent, to the state hospital, then it's the determination of the subcommittee, and I think most legal scholars and authorities, that the ultimate decision of discharge back to society ought to rest with the court. Now, I suppose there again we see the animosity, in a sense, that underlies law and psychiatry. And I think we ought to be frank to recognize it. Too many times, psychiatrists are viewed as overly permissive. Let this fellow back on the street that ought not to be back there. Society doesn't want him back there, but the doctor says he's all right. Let's let him go. Well, this is the conflict and basic problems between the legal view, I suppose, and the medical view. Well, the enlightened judge in the policy here, we feel, is the one who best would express the feelings of society, not necessarily the legal profession, but the feelings of the jury that put the man there originally. And I suppose that in 99 cases out of 100, the judge would, of course, accept the state superintendent's recommendation. But in the one case, perhaps, where because of the heinous crime, because of the reaction of the public, because it would be extremely damaging to both professions, psychiatry and the law, and the system of justice, to allow a particular person back on the street, that the court would be able to say, keep him. We don't want him out. Now, that's a very sketchy view of what Section 10 does, and there are many detailed procedures for filing of notice and for burden of proof allocations at different stages. This sums it up, I think.
Is there something in there? Can this person have an examination by another psychiatrist to get back into that kind of thing again? Or is this strictly just what the state psychiatrists say?
No, he can have his own.
I couldn't remember what it was.
Yes. Let's assume that he is committed by the court to state hospital, and we provide him here a minimum stay of 90 days is required, so that he can't be turned back out through the same revolving door by the doctors. The feeling here that the doctors may object to this, and this is one of the reasons we want to discuss it. But at any rate, at the end of the 90 days, the superintendent and the psychiatrist for the state feel that the man is no longer dangerous, and perhaps maybe not even mentally defective and diseased anymore. And they tell the court this. At that point, the state, if it wishes to object, must have the burden of proof itself in keeping that person there. Now, this is a very important thing, I think, because if the burden is left on the defendant, as it is in the first instance, to prove his own insanity, it's much more difficult. But here, the state superintendent says this man should be released to society. And unless the state comes in and puts on its case, then in that sense, the state's psychiatrists are the dependent psychiatrists. But if the state superintendent refuses to grant release, and there's a petition procedure allowed here for the inmate, that is the person committed to the hospital, if he files seeking his release, of course he's entitled to his own psychiatrist and would proceed much as the original trial would be to decide the issue of dangerousness.
Doesn't the draft also provide that at any time during the five-year period, upon an appropriate showing, the individual can be released from custody to supervision?
That's correct.
Or
he need not be released outright. He may be released as in the original case to society on the supervision.
And the burden of proof would remain with the defendant whenever the head of the state hospital felt he was dangerous.
That's right. With the exception of the five-year automatic hearing, I believe.
At the five-year automatic, at the end of 5 years.
Yeah, that's still the same rule. That's right.
Still the same rule. Still on the defendant if at that point the hospital felt
right.
It's yeah. Not the only section that I feel that I'm certain that we're probably right on.
Well, I
don't know.
I think this.
I'm with you.
I think that we're going to. I'm sorry that the doctors from the state hospital who were invited here today weren't here, because I suspect that if the commission takes action and approves the basic draft of Section 10, I suspect that we'll have a real fight on our hands with the people at the state hospital.
You will.
Because I would imagine that they just rise up in holy horror at this.
But I think it's a good, I think it's an extraordinarily good section. One of the byproducts of using my legislative newspaper subscription to get the Washington Post is that in the 1967 session, there was a series of articles in the Post on the Maryland law, which is substantially this way. And I think it's just excellent. There's a question that's always been in my mind, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the equal protection question, and whether or not it might be argued that you've got a denial of equal protection of the law. I assume probably, George, that you went into this.
With respect to what particular element? Yeah.
Well, with respect to persons acquitted and their, you have this five-year period here that, where they're committed for a five-year term, although they can apply to get out before just the overall, the whole overall question of whether or not it doesn't in fact constitute incarceration. He's acquitted, nevertheless he's still incarcerated.
And under more stringent circumstances than the guy that never was charged, although maybe the same condition mentally.
Correct.
Well, I recognize the problem.
The parole, the whole overview of it, I don't know.
Well, he isn't committed for 5 years.
No, he's not given a 5-year term. That's a
no.
It's for his protection, actually. This is one of the built-in protective devices, so that he must be assured of periodic reviews, either on the basis of his own petition or automatically at the end of 5 years. And this burden is put on the hospital to keep track of the 5-year period and to inform the court 30 days ahead of time when the 5-year period of retention in the hospital has expired.
I wonder if the doctors here would express themselves on, because this is clearly a substantial change in our present situation, and I don't know how many of you have spent any time on the staff at the state hospital, either here or elsewhere. I simply don't know, but I wonder if each of you would comment on Section 10 and on the broad scheme that we're talking about.
Well, I'm very sorry there are not representatives from the state hospital here today so that we could hear them, because I suspect it would require substantial changes in their record keeping, in their practices, particularly having to get approval of the court to discharge a person.
Do you think the court should make that determination, Dr. Butler? In other words, after he's been acquitted by reason of insanity, he's committed, found dangerous, and so on, and then time comes on his motion or the state hospital's motion.
I think the court will be most in tune with community attitudes more than the mental hospital would be, yes, and I think that the court can appropriately take a role. Just exactly how it would, how well it would work, I don't know, but I do feel that they are going to be more attuned with community attitudes than the mental hospital is currently.
What do you think, Dr. Boyce?
I would tend to agree with Dr. Butler. I think it's a function of the community as represented in the court to make a determination about this kind of matter. And certainly there are going to be problems administratively with the hospital, but then maybe that's a function of the legislature to find more money or some other way of handling the problems that would accrue as a result of changing things this way.
Dr. Smith, what reaction?
I would agree that this should be the court's decision. And I'm sure I'm not as familiar as I should be with the Section 10, but it looks very good to me. I think it will impose more work on the state hospital, but they might be able to handle it. Tangential point that might come up, perhaps it's provided for in here, but not too long ago, a young individual was found not guilty by virtue of, I think, a schizophrenic process reaction in the District of Columbia, was sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for treatment. The parents of this young person, after some time, felt that he wasn't getting any treatment, and they went back to court. Perhaps you're all familiar with this, but they obtained his release to the outside on the basis of his not receiving treatment. And I think Judge Bazelon has written an article of the right to treatment or something of this nature, that we can't just provide a custodial placement for these people if they are indeed ill. Then they are entitled to whatever treatment is available. If none is available, that's a different matter.
Can you speak to that, Professor Platt? Well, did you run across that?
Yes,
case?
The case is familiar to me, and it is a proper decision. If we're sending people to a hospital for treatment and they're not being treated, and that would include the Oregon Hospital, then they ought to be discharged. They're not getting equal protection of the law. They're not getting what the system has put them there for. And they can raise this either under the petition in Section 10 or under a habeas corpus. It probably came up under habeas corpus in D.C., I don't remember. But it is proper to discharge that kind of a person, although he might be the most dangerous person in the world. After all, it's our own system then that's breaking down. It's not that individual that ought to bear the burden. It ought to be us providing for more money, more facilities in order to take care of these kids.
Dr. Boyce?
Well, do they define what treatment is?
No.
Basically, a can of worms.
Well, that's a medical institution.
In this case, actually, it was the testimony of the physicians in charge of the patient at St. Elizabeth's to the point that, no, he wasn't getting any treatment, however they defined it, and affected this escape hatch release.
Dr. Butler?
I'm interested in what Dr. Hogan has told us about some of the people who have mental illnesses, but he feels they're better off in the penitentiary. Might it be that we will err in the direction of having people go to mental hospitals when they would be more appropriately dealt with, even in terms of vocational rehabilitation? There are workshops and other activities. When he says that it's a better way of life in the penitentiary for people who might not respond to, quote, treatment,
the state hospital could furnish these things in time with funds.
They don't have them in the same.
Right. They don't have them
degree now.
Yeah,
true.
I think personally that this section should be adopted, whether or not you change the rule in regard to responsibility. And if I were a superintendent of the state hospital, I think I would prefer to have the matter decided this way. You have a constantly changing staff in a state hospital. You have residents. You have people with various amounts of experience. The superintendent of a large hospital cannot personally acquaint himself with all of the details of all of these cases. He has to go on the basis of staff recommendation. And again, as I say, I'd feel a little bit uncertain in many of these situations. If I, as superintendent, had to take the whole responsibility, I'd prefer that the judge would take it. In regard to this matter of being released because they're not being treated, of course, this is a rather a ridiculous thing because of the fact that medicine is limited in what we have. Suppose we have a person with multiple sclerosis. There is no known treatment for it. It is just not available. We don't know that much, and so we discharge him. And you say this is the blame of society. Well, I don't know that you can rightfully blame society because of our present state of ignorance.
Why don't we take a short break?
Fine.
Okay.
I agree.
The law that we have is the strongest law on the statute books. That is that our Constitution does not permit gambling in the state of Oregon. We talked about the pinball machines and others that were put out. They were put out just because someone had the intestinal fortitude to see that they were, that this law was observed. I happen to know how the dart games were put out of the city of Portland because someone went to the grand jury and quoted the Constitution of the state of Oregon and the charter of the city of Portland. They offered $15,000 a year to the city to allow a dart game to go into Portland. They wanted to put in 4 dart games, you know, and those were only paying off like your bingo games that are held to the churches in Portland as well as others. Now, if you, if anybody wants to put a gambling device out of the city, out of the state of Oregon, they should go before the legislature and invoke that constitution. Now, in someone just spoke about stealing from someone else to promote because they want to gamble. Now, I have worked at this legislature for 15 sessions, which is 30 years. I'm MD. Now, I'm the only living founder of the Portland Federation of Women's Organizations. I didn't mean to say that. It came before this legislature where a school clerk got the money to pay the teachers and went to Portland thinking that with all that money money, he surely can